Welcome to another exciting episode of NID's Knowledge, this one being Real Space Strategy Edition. This podcast is produced by the National Institute for Deterrence Studies, where we are advancing peace, promoting stability, and helping you to think deterrence. Each week, we will inform you about the latest in space strategy and its importance to our national defense. Well, listeners to this podcast are no strangers to Starlink, the mega constellation of space-based internet services created by Elon Musk's SpaceX and its many uses for civilian and military purposes. However, today we have a guest that has some other ideas for using Starlink to advance what he calls informational freedom for captive populations struggling for liberty worldwide. Our guest today is Elon Berman, Senior Vice President of the American Foreign Policy Council. Former professor of mine, at least, and a prolific writer. So, Elon, thanks again for joining us on Real Space Strategy.
Oh, my pleasure.
Awesome. So you wrote back in September now an editorial in Newsweek where you brought up your idea of leveraging Starlink for some interesting uses. So a few included, quote, as a tool to empower Iranian dissidents, assist humanitarian organizations operating in war zones like Gaza or Ukraine, as a means for aiding informational freedom. What do you mean by that, informational freedom?
Well, so a couple of things, and advisedly, I'm enormously flattered, enormously humbled to be invited on the podcast because I'm not a space expert. I do a lot of things that abut space, that are proximate to space, and that includes, you know, watching, you know, Russia, China, in terms of their grand strategy, but it also includes lots of discussions of public diplomacy. And the thing that really I think most people don't understand is the degree to which all of these things are interwoven. And I think it's particularly true in the case of information flow. And so what we've seen, right, to sort of to zoom out, to back up, what we've seen is a real transformation in recent years of the informational environment, where you've had, you know, the traditional news that I grew up with. I'm older than you, Chris, but, you know, that I grew up with was very predictable. It followed a certain cadence, a certain pattern, newspaper in the morning, ABC nightly news at night. What we have now is worlds different. We have a 24/7 digital stream. It's a crowded, it's a competitive media environment, and the barriers for entry are lower. And so what you have is, this is the context in which I'm watching what China's doing in space and what Russia is doing in space. And so I was really struck by the latent potential of technologies that we look at in the context of sometimes we don't look at it in the context of public diplomacy, but really have public diplomacy effects. Starlink was started as a for-profit venture, right? You know, upfront, mm-hmm. right? This is not a charity case. To connect, it's made enormous strides, right? Starlink has something like 6,000 satellites deployed currently. Has made real strides in terms of providing connectivity, for example, in the American heartland. And most recently, we've seen Starlink being provided in both public and not so public fashion for the, in places like North Carolina and Florida to reestablish connectivity in the wake of the latest hurricane. But Starlink also, because of its latent potential, because it is not impervious, but certainly less vulnerable to the type of jamming, the type of blocking, the type of interference that terrestrial media is subject to from authoritarian regimes that don't want the free flow of information, it also has an ancillary use. And the ancillary use is to provide persistent, stable, reliable communications in denied environments like Ukraine, to assist humanitarian efforts in places like Gaza. And not yet, but maybe soon, Starlink will be used to provide greater connectivity to the disparate arms of the Iranian opposition as they organize against the regime, because the regime has, over the last several years, instituted a pretty comprehensive crackdown on the internet as a way of trying to disaggregate its opposition. So Starlink is important from a technological connectivity basis, but it's also very important from a freedom promotion basis because it has the capability, the surge capability, to use sort of that could empower opposition movements, could empower democracy activists, could really change the game in a lot of frontiers of freedom.
Right. So speaking of China, I know you mentioned in your editorial that China is looking at doing something similar between 2025 and 2030. I find this interesting because I'm not sure if you knew this or not, but there are numerous writings by credible Chinese military authors, not those that are customarily, you know, writing for public consumption, especially Western public consumption, but legitimate folks in engineering departments seeking to find ways to, their words, kill Starlink. And it appears that they really see Starlink, as a lot of Americans see, just as an internet broadband service with numerous applications. They see it as a big threat to them, and yet they want their own, and then some. So you argue that there are some that are concerned that it could increase not only China's ability to carry out surveillance activities at scale, or augment its already very broad media censorship capability. So why do you think that is possible? With their own version of Starlink, that these and even some propaganda efforts could become more of a problem.
Okay,
for our friends in those countries.
Sure. That's a lot of stuff. So let me try to unpack it for you. This is a little bit of a lengthy answer, and I'll start with a pop culture reference because you love those, Chris, and you love
yes, absolutely.
So the listeners might be familiar with the name Willie Sutton, right? So Willie Sutton was. Now of legend, was a bank robber in the United States in the 1930s and 1940s. He carried out a string of robberies in Pennsylvania and in Ohio and in the central United States. And when the authorities caught up with him, the story goes, almost assuredly an urban legend, but nonetheless, the story goes that they put him in a cell to sweat him, and the FBI came in and they asked him, Willie, why do you rob the banks? And he says, well, it's because that's where the money is. And right, funny story, but it actually has geopolitical applications because in the context of what great powers, and here I'm not just talking about the United States and China, I'm also talking about countries like Russia, also countries like Iran, countries that have imperial aspirations. Mm-hmm. What they're doing is they're trying to increase their influence and their leverage in places where the people are. And the most important place in this context is Africa. Africa right now is 1.3 billion people, but the birth rate on the continent is off the charts. And by 2080 or so, the continent's going to basically double in terms of population. And the continent is going to end up being something like a fifth of humanity. And right now, this is virgin territory. Mm-hmm. Today, Africa is only 40% digitally connected. And so this is a huge prize. This is part of the reason why China is investing so much of its focus in its Belt and Road Initiative, which is the signature foreign policy initiative of the CCP, on cultivating Africa, because they know that that's where the people are. That's where the people are going to be. And this is true in the digital domain as well. Right? Because as I said, Africa right now is only 40% connected, but that connectivity is experiencing explosive growth. So what we're talking about really is a zero-sum game. We're talking about Starlink in the context of broadband connectivity, but in terms of a geopolitical fast mover, the Starlink plan, right? It's in the open source, it's out in the open. The Starlink plan is to do have a global constellation of 40,000 satellites. And there is really no near peer to Starlink. There's no other company that's doing anything resembling the type of scale and the type of vision that Starlink is doing. Mm-hmm. Except the Chinese government has articulated an opposing vision in very much a zero-sum sort of way. So the Chinese plan currently calls for, right, what we saw in August was the launch of an initial tranche of very small tranche of something like 18 satellites by one of three Chinese government-supported conglomerates that cumulatively by 2030 are going to either meet or exceed the Starlink target of 40,000 satellites. So That seems like a separate data point from what I talked about earlier with regard to Africa, but it's not. Because what we're actually talking about is who will provide information in the form of low latency data and internet services to a continent that is exploding in terms of growth. Mm-hmm. Now, the operating question that I ask you, I ask all the listeners is, how many cable providers do you have? The answer is one, because you only need one, right? You either have in the DC area, right? Comcast, Verizon, and you know maybe some other Johnny Come Latelys, but that's mm-hmm. what you have. You don't have more than one because you don't need it. And the same is going to be true in Africa. If China beats the West, and here, you know, Starlink is sort of the stand-in for the West, but this is broadly what we're talking about. If China beats us to the punch and fields that constellation of 40,000 satellites that could provide space internet for the world, but mostly for Africa, which is now virgin territory, at least for now, mm-hmm. it will be the one that gets to choose which channels go on that service, which radio stations Africans get to hear and they don't get to hear, and which ads and which propaganda get streamed to 2.5 billion people. And that's a big deal. And it's a big deal because it will put us behind the eight ball of an informational contest that we're already not very good at. We're already behind Russian disinformation, behind Chinese disinformation, behind Iranian propaganda efforts in terms of the scope and scale of the complexity. This has the potential to make the situation much, much worse.
Yeah, definitely. I can see why you express the concern you do, given that, as you mentioned, the Belt and Road Initiative includes, and I know we've had several episodes on this with other guests, but the Space Silk Road, and sometimes the subset of that's called what they call the Space Information Corridor, that frankly put the control of not just communications, but of numerous industries, segments of society that Chinese are building for these countries. So it could be infrastructure, critical infrastructure, power systems, everything that are based on like the Beidou position, navigation, and timing system. So basically, kind of like how Russia with Eastern and some parts of Western Europe can turn off the spigot of natural gas, Beijing could potentially turn off everything, especially with the push for so-called smart cities, which I'm considering calling them dumb cities, just because you're basically making everything integrated into a point where one person can flip the switch and you lose everything, plumbing, electricity, access to information, things of that sort. So I had a student of mine when I taught briefly at Missouri State that wrote a paper that I brought her on to talk about that she called Beidou the satellite constellation of vassalage. And I thought that was quite accurate. So if they can control what industries people work on or not by turning on and off timing signals, then linking things further into a Chinese Starlink system can only become more problematic. And it sounds like sort of like a space-based Berlin Wall that the right. Chinese are aiming to create and spread. Does that sound about right?
So that sounds exactly right. And I'll hearken back to a different context, a different president than we have now, but Barack Obama back in, I believe it was 2010, 2011, he was talking about Iranian censorship efforts. And he talked about how a digital curtain has descended on the Islamic Republic, right? Because the Iranian regime was more and more capable and willing to essentially filter out the internet to prevent connectivity, right? They were sort of coming off of the so-called Green Movement, which was at that time the greatest threat to the Islamic Republic in its history since 1979. And so they were getting very smart, by the way, with Chinese help, very smart, very quickly on censorship. And a lot of that censorship was weighted on, sort of focused on how to either slow down or interrupt the internet. And so this is what we're talking about. We're talking about this on a grand scale, on a global scale. But mm-hmm. even on a more basic level than what we're saying, right? So what you're talking about, right? Turning off the switch and whatever it is, this is the sort of the extreme situation. But even on a more basic level, if you think about as I said, right, we only need one cable provider. If you think about scrolling the channels on your television, on your cable set, you have, living here, different channels than somebody in Toronto does, right? Because mm-hmm. the lineup is built, and it's built by the cable provider. Now, it doesn't take a genius to understand that anything controlled by the CCP will probably not include documentaries from the Voice of America or footage that Radio Free Asia wants you to see or content from the Middle East broadcasting networks or anything like that. Any sort of Western penetration, what the Iranians call West toxification. Mm-hmm. The Chinese have a different word for it. I don't know how to say it because I don't speak Mandarin. But mm-hmm. nonetheless, it's exactly that, right? It's the Chinese get to curate the reality. And so they're building the capability. They already can do it for their domestic population. But through the Belt and Road and through all these ancillary roads, right? I hate the name Belt and Road because it's more than one belt, one road, right? It's many things. But the idea is not only to impose the Chinese model, but to curate, increasingly to curate the reality and the daily lives of all these countries that the Belt and Road is touching. And with this satellite launch, right, the Chinese are making a first serious foray into doing that in the informational space as well.
Yeah, I remember one time I went to Vietnam with an Air Force group several years ago, and we were up in the mountains near Laos to go look at the Khe Sanh Fire Base as part of a kind of like a staff ride kind of a trip. And I noticed that there were tons and tons of these shack houses that don't have doors, they don't have windows, they clearly don't have plumbing, but they all have little satellite dishes tacked on the top of their roofs. And initially, probably back, you know, to 20, 30 years ago, it was radio that would bounce off the atmosphere, and Hanoi would be able to send out whatever they wanted to send out to everybody in the hills. But now it's satellite because you can do more with that. I guess on a side note, one thing that I find interesting lately in the DC policy sphere is that despite everything that you've talked about, there seems to be a lot of people in Congress, even some in the executive branch, academia, who seem to find Starlink, Elon Musk's quest for promoting free speech and communications, like he has in many countries, like you mentioned, just a few, even at home with the hurricane victims. I don't understand this, the whole negativity. So why do you think some of our elected leadership are fighting against him rather than the Chinese, or, you know, why not leverage American commercial capabilities like Starlink as a means to counter space BRI efforts that harm freedom and actually make more people captive into tyranny? It seems a little awkward.
No, it does. But that's usually not the frame the lens through which most people see Musk or see his efforts, right? I mean, listen, he's a quirky guy, and he has his fingers in a lot of pies. He's, you know, nothing if not erratic and all over the place in terms of his interests. He's doing everything from building flamethrowers to shooting cars, right?
Around the sun.
Sedans around the sun. Right, exactly. So there's a lot of noise in this. And in that noise, in that erratic movement, and by the way, the whole Twitter debate has sort of subsumed everything else that he's doing. I sort of see Twitter as a sideshow to the much more important and strategic things mm-hmm. like space launch, like brain computer interface things that he's doing, right? But Twitter seems to be occupying a lot of his time these days, including because of late he seems to have political ambitions. And so, you know, who knows where this goes? But that's the overlay, right? Because right. this is increasingly political, because America in recent times is increasingly inward looking and we're fighting with each other. We don't see that broader frame. We don't see that broader frame of this being a systems clash, an ideological competition with the CCP. And if we don't, like, for political reasons or because we think he's just strange or whatever, if we don't like Elon Musk on Twitter, then we might not really care so much if the hard left government of Brazilian President Lula da Silva essentially deplatforms him and makes Twitter sort of obsolete and is banned Starlink or, you know, whatever it is. Mm-hmm. We don't fight for him as much as we should because we don't have the proper frame. And so I don't think he does himself any favors, But I think it would be a lot better if more people understood, first of all, that this is a grand contest, right? That this is great power competition, not just in terms of supply chains and in terms of, you know, where we get our microchips or whatever it is, but that it's literally happening along almost every conceivable domain. And information is one of them. And so therefore, Musk is a player, and we want him to be a player on our side. And also that we don't have any competitors. If we understood this frame, if we understood that this was a systems clash, that we need to win the informational contest against the CCP, it's fine if you don't like Elon Musk. But then you need to devote resources to creating companies like Starlink that can, instead of Starlink, compete with the CCP. And we don't have anything like that. And so I see that as a real problem. In the absence of alternatives, Starlink is who we have to get behind.
Yeah, Amazon's supposed to be working on their own system called Kuiper, but you know, Blue Origin, the space wing of Amazon, is not really doing much, and they've been very slow at getting anything done, while SpaceX is just doing a lot of great stuff in a short amount of time. One thing that that came to my mind is also kind of related is that recently, and by recently I mean like in the last 6, 7, 8 months, FCC created a space division, and they've been engaged in space licensing and all sorts of other fun stuff regarding, satellite communications, radio transmissions, anything of that sort that transitions through the electromagnetic spectrum. I'm curious if you've heard anything about whether or not the FCC is on board with a great power competition style way of thinking. It seems I haven't heard much from them. And I guess one of the other things that I'll just add to this is, I think I'd mentioned before, maybe either in an editorial or on another one of my podcasts, is when you mentioned your great power competition that everybody seems to talk about, but nobody ever seems to talk about winning. It's like this competition is just, it's just there and it's going to go on forever. And we don't really have any aspirations to do anything. But if what you say is accurate, and I'd have no reason to doubt you because I know exactly what you're talking about and I've seen it all and I've asked these questions myself, is, if Africa is in all sorts of Eurasia and Oceania and all these other places that Belt and Road is touching and beyond, and it's basically encircling the Western Hemisphere and even penetrating parts of the Western Hemisphere, why aren't we pushing for a winning grand strategy? As you mentioned, this is a grand strategic effort, but it seems like we're kind of just playing a game of a word game and not so much taking it seriously. What's your thoughts on that?
So no. So I think that's exactly right. And, I'm in violent agreement that we're terrible at great power competition. We're excellent at talking about great power competition and the need to compete. We're far worse at articulating a call to action, a vision of victory, a sort of a fulsome strategy for how to successfully compete across these domains. And you know this much better than I, but space is one of those places that's really deserves a lot of top level attention because we don't have a national North Star vision for space. The Chinese do, mm-hmm. right? But to answer your question, I think from where I'm sitting, I think the problem is twofold. First of all, words matter. So you went under the Trump administration from the frame of great power competition to the first part of the Biden administration being long-term strategic competition, and now to managed competition. And those are distinctions with a difference. Because mm-hmm. once you fall into the frame of management, it is less about competing. It is more about making sure that the relationship, even though it's adversarial, doesn't really go off the rails in a fundamental way. And that discourages you from thinking competitively, right? Mm-hmm. And to its credit, the White House has done a whole bunch of things, right? The Uyghur Forced Labor Act and things like that, things to hold the Chinese accountable for certain aspects of their behavior. But what is not yet in evidence, as far as I can tell, is a grand strategy for competing across all these multiple domains on the part of the White House. So that's the first thing. The second thing is that I think we don't have the proper frame for great power competition. Mm-hmm. And even though some elected officials give lip service to it, we still are very, very clearly downsizing great power competition to just be about China. But it's not just about China. Increasingly, you're seeing all this strategic confluence, this ominous convergence between China and Russia and Iran, right? For my money, America is in this unique moment, right? We're 248 years old. We're a young country. For the first time in our history, we are facing not one, not two, but three incipient empires. And they're all trying to, first of all, they're all collaborating on tactics. They're collaborating on disinformation and information warfare and suppression of their opposition movements and military exercises and what have you. But they're also trying to revise the global order. And I would argue that even if we were serious about China, we'd still be in a bind because we haven't really stopped and pulled back and accounted for the fact that even if China is our pacing threat, and I think it is across multiple domains, its capabilities and its ambitions are being augmented by the type of cooperation it's doing with the Russians and the Iranians. But we're not even there, right? In the sense that we don't really see the full picture. And far be it from seeing the full picture, we haven't even articulated a strategy against China. So we have a lot of work to do.
Yeah, I'm not a fan of the phrase pacing threat because here's a pop culture reference for you. I'm not a NASCAR fan, but I do know that they have a thing called a pacing car.
Yeah, correct.
And the pacing car is basically everybody follows it, and they're not very proactive. So you don't see the cars passing the pacing car to try to lead the pacing car. So if we are really going to be leaders of a international order, as we like to keep saying, then you can't look at the threats to that order and your national interests and those of your allies as, oh, we're waiting for them to move first and then we'll follow suit. You have to be more proactive. And so instead of me going off on a tangent and giving my thoughts on this, I like to give a lot of my guests a chance to answer the king for a day question. So if you were appointed to be the guy that was responsible for coming up with a solution to this issue that you wrote briefly about in your editorial and that we've spoke about today, what would your solution be?
So I think it's more than, you know, just a couple of a minute answer, but I'll content myself with this. Nothing happens if you don't capture the conscience of the king, right? In the information space, what we've had is a bipartisan lack of attention. Across multiple administrations, Republicans and Democrats, there haven't really been presidents who have taken seriously the idea that we are in a competitive informational contest and we have to have a strategy to win it. We have to have a coherent message to global publics and we have to understand that other countries do. We haven't sort of right-sized our budgets. We haven't really taken a look at this as a competitive enterprise. That's compounded by the fact that this is essentially an unfunded mandate from the congressional perspective. If you talk to journalists from the Voice of America or Radio Free Asia or what have you, it'll take you exactly 30 seconds for them to complain that they can't get any members of Congress to give their comments, right? They really can't interview. And that's because the constituency for those members of Congress is not abroad in Bangladesh or in Switzerland or wherever it is, it's at home. So they'd much rather do C-SPAN. They'd much rather do Fox or CNN or MSNBC. There's no margin in it for them to do messaging externally outside of the borders of the United States. But it's super important because foreign audiences, in order to get with the American program, they have to understand the American program. And that means explaining policy. That means explaining legislative decisions. That means contextualizing how America sees the world, telling America's story in a much more fulsome way. So the short answer, right? That was a sort of a big tee up to a short answer. But the short answer is that if I were king for a day, I would inject a lot more seriousness in the form of policy intention, but also in the form of budgets into our national informational enterprise.
Well, speaking of that, I had a follow-up question popped in my head as you were talking. So back in the Cold War, we had an office called the U.S. Information Agency.
Right.
And after the Cold War supposedly ended, they rolled it under the State Department into some little bureau of the State Department, supposedly. I haven't seen a whole lot of activity coming out of that office. And if I remember right, I read some articles or something somewhere where people were complaining about how it's been very lame and pretty much a nowheresville kind of a posting. Do you think that maybe we need to bring that kind of an agency back? And if so, with a space division, kind of like FCC and the Department of Commerce and all these other offices and departments are working on too for their parts of the pie.
Well, so the process, the sort of the post-Cold War dismantlement, went a little bit differently. So what happened was in the late 1990s, 1999, under the watchful eye of the Clinton administration, Congress passed and then President Clinton approved the disaggregation of USIA. And in its stead, there were parts that went into the State Department. But there were also, they created a separate agency that was then known as the Broadcasting Board of Governors. It is today known as the U.S. Agency for Global Media. And they did this weird hybrid structure, part public, part private. So Voice of America is a public agency nested under USAGM, but then there are grantees like Radio Free Europe and they're on the private side. Anyway, it's super confusing. Mm-hmm. But the big problem, right, the structure is not actually as much of a problem as this massive attrition of strategic vision. Because what you have and what has been passed down and has trickled down through all these regulations and all this, sort of, you know, these bureaucracies not walking in lockstep is this understanding that these are just journalists that happen to work for the United States that are reporting on things that are happening in foreign locales, but are sort of reporting on it in a less attractive, less dynamic way than cable media. Right. Mm-hmm. And so we're not really competitive in that space. The secret sauce for what made USIA so attractive and so important and so impactful in the Cold War struggle was that we were really, it was America messaging. It was, this was America's story. It was clear that if you were behind the Iron Curtain, if you were a captive nation, you could tune in to whether it was Radio Free Europe or Voice of America, and you would hear stories that your governments were not willing to let you hear, right? So it was sort of this forbidden fruit. Obviously, the media landscape has changed pretty dramatically. We're much more wired and much more connected. We have the ancillary problem of disinformation, which is now being turbocharged by technologies like artificial intelligence. That forces us to really do a serious rethink of how we do strategic influence. And that's been many years lacking. And I think that the need is becoming more and more urgent. And I hope, right, to sort of to come full circle, I hope that soon we're going to have a chief executive that actually understands the importance of this as a top level national priority. We haven't had one since for decades, right? I would argue since the end of the Cold War. Since the removal of the Soviet Union as this organizing principle in our national security strategy. But now we have this multifaceted, complex threat that is being animated and is being augmented by our lack of attention to this critical domain.
Right. Well, this obviously is something that we could do numerous episodes on. Obviously, there's many layers to this, including even the space and counterspace activity side of it. Like, how do you keep your message from being cut off by the other side? But for now, we've ran out of time. So Elon Berman, Senior Vice President, American Foreign Policy Council, and prolific author, thanks very much for joining us on Real Space Strategy.
Oh, thanks for having me on.
Awesome. And again, this is Christopher Stone with Real Space Strategy. Thanks for listening. Thank you for listening to NIDS Knowledge, Real Space Strategy. The Real Space Strategy Edition is produced under NIDS Podcasting Network, a division of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies. NIDS is a 501c3 organization dependent on donations to provide this podcast and bring about awareness of the peacekeeping value of U.S. strength and our national deterrence. You can catch all of our podcasts or provide feedback at thinkdeterrence.com. I want to thank our producer, Kimberly Sherrington, our sponsors, and all the fantastic members of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies for making this podcast possible. Stay tuned next week for another exciting and informative NIDS Knowledge.